Good evening. We're speaking to you now from the auditorium of Rochester High School. This is the First District Sasson for Governor Volunteers Banquet and Radio Broadcast. Mr. Harold E. Sasson will be introduced by W.C. Christensen, City Attorney for Red Wing in Goodhue County. Mr. Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, honored guests, members of the Sasson for Governor Volunteers of the 1st Congressional District, and men and women of Minnesota. We are fast approaching the time when the Republican Party must choose its standard bearer for what promises to be a very strenuous campaign. Of that leader, the rank and file of the party will expect and have a right to expect certain things. They want a man who possesses a definite and high conception of the province and purposes of government in order that he may truly interpret and give voice to the aspirations and wishes of the people of the state who are loudly insisting that maladministration and inefficiency in our state government be definitely ended. They want a vigorous and able campaigner, a man who can and will successfully lead and direct the battle. A man who in the heat of the campaign, when weaker men might be tempted to do so, will not resort to evasion or the weasel words of politicians. Moreover, they desire a man about whom laboring men, farmers, and businessmen, regardless of their past party affiliation, can now rally with a complete assurance that his election as chief executive of Minnesota will give our state a truly good and efficient administration. We have with us tonight a man who some weeks ago was advanced as a candidate for governor of our state. It was then said that he possesses the qualities to which I have just referred. Critical analysis shows beyond any doubt that those who brought him forth were correct in their appraisal of him. His background, his unquestioned ability, his experience and success as a lawyer and county attorney, his courage and integrity, his demonstrated qualities of leadership, his sound and sincere progressivism, reveal him as a logical Republican candidate for governor of Minnesota. And now it gives me great pleasure and pride to present to you the man, Harold E. Sasson.
Mr. Christensen, honored guests and friends, it is a distinct honor and pleasure to meet with you men and women of all parties here in the city of Rochester tonight. The 1st Congressional District can be justly proud of its rich farming land, its varied industries, and its resourceful citizens. It can also be proud of its able and distinguished representative in Congress, the Honorable August H. Andreessen. I wish to express to you, men and women of the 1st District, my sincere appreciation for arranging this splendid occasion. I would also thank those men and women throughout the state who have stepped forward as volunteers to carry on the drive launched by the people of my home county on November 18th. I say to you all tonight that I trust that my future conduct shall be such that none of you shall ever regret your part in these early stages of this campaign. I recognize, as you do, that our task is a difficult one. The bosses of the present machine-controlled government are deeply entrenched on Capitol Hill. They are collecting a tremendous campaign fund and are insisting that every employee of the state must be a corporal in their political army. But every day, the conviction grows that the state government of Minnesota needs a change. I assure you that I will make a hard, vigorous, untiring fight to see that it is changed. This battle against odds will be won. Tonight, I intend to continue speaking frankly and plainly on the problems of the state. I know that it is about as hard to pin some politicians down to the issues as it is to catch the greased pig at the county fair. Such elusiveness may be clever, but it does not contribute to the solution of our problems. With our government in a critical condition, I propose to speak frankly and plainly, straight from the shoulder, regardless of the political consequences. It is natural tonight in the city of Rochester that our thoughts should turn to the medical profession, that profession which throughout the years, day and night, has answered the call of men and women of every walk of life to relieve human suffering. The family doctor cannot close his eyes to unpleasant facts. His diagnosis must be candid and his treatment proper. Acute appendicitis cannot be treated or referred to as an ordinary stomach ache, even though the patient and the family might be temporarily happier if the true facts are concealed. In the method of the medical profession, then, let us proceed tonight to diagnose one of our most important and serious ailments of the state and prescribe a course of treatment. Any study of the conditions of Minnesota immediately brings forcefully to our attention those 144,000 of men and women who make up our army of the unemployed. These men and women, together with their families, would constitute a city 15 to 20 times the size of the city of Rochester, and would more than equal the population of the entire 1st Congressional District. In this state, in 1937, they gave rise to a relief burden of $16 million and to WPA expenditures of $31 million. These large expenditures fell heavily, directly and indirectly, on every man and woman of the state. The farmers in particular, who could not hide the North 40 or the Red Barn when the tax assessor came around, bore an unduly heavy share of this tax burden on their broad acres. Now, almost all of these unemployed are men and women who, by heritage, by training, and by their own desires, want to find a job and take their places in the busy stream of commerce. They do not want to place a tax burden of $20 on every man, woman, and child in the state for their support. This unemployment problem unquestionably constitutes the most important issue facing the people of the state of Minnesota. What can be done about it? One thing is certain. It cannot be cured by leading parades in New York or making speeches in California. It can be cured only by making more jobs in private employment in Minnesota. Now, I recognize to a great degree, our unemployment problem is national in scope. But do you know that the loss of employment in the manufacturing industries in Minnesota has been greater than the national average? Do you know that this loss of employment has been almost three times greater in Minnesota than it was in the states of Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and Ohio? Minnesota did not enjoy its share of the re-employment in the upswing last spring. We have not secured our share of new jobs because we have not attracted our share of new industries. In other words, here in Minnesota, in addition to the unemployment caused by national factors, we have further unemployment caused by local conditions. And I contend that the responsibility for this added unemployment in Minnesota lies at the door of the present state administration. To furnish more jobs, we must attract and develop new industries. Now, we have many advantages from an industrial standpoint. Our state was endowed by our Creator with great natural resources, equaled in very few states. Our state is inhabited by men and women who, by heritage, by education, and by training, are among the ablest and most efficient workmen that can be found anywhere in the world. Many of our sons, in years gone by, have shown the inventive genius and the initiative to establish enterprises manufacturing products that have found a national demand. We also have splendid facilities for transportation by rail, by water, by air, and by truck. But on the other hand, what are our handicaps in attracting new industries? They are threefold. First, freight rates, because the bulk of manufactured products is carried to the heavy population centers in the East. Second, an unusually high tax burden, which weighs down upon all industry and business in Minnesota. And third, our labor relations. Our state government can and should assist in correcting the second and third of these disadvantages. The extravagant, wasteful practices of the present state administration, with its lethargy in promoting industrial peace, its entire disregard for traditional virtues of thrift and economy, its reckless borrowing on future credit, its mortgaging of future generations to build political machines today, not only lays a heavy burden upon the broad acres of the farmers of Minnesota, but it weighs down like a wet blanket over every business in the state, and it must be stopped. Plants that are barely making ends meet lose hope under increased burdens and go out of business. Others take advantage of opportunities to move to other states. And each time, Minnesota's army of unemployed is unnecessarily increased. And each time, a heavier burden falls in turn upon the remaining citizens of the state. It is a vicious circle, and it piles burden upon burden, just as one stone rolling down the hillside loosens and brings after it many other stones of varying sizes. Yet our state administration, in the face of these problems, does nothing to correct them and spends its time building a stronger, bigger political machine. How like modern Neros with their political fiddling. Is it any wonder that the conviction grows in the hearts and minds of the men and women of Minnesota that the state government of Minnesota must be changed? Injures the cause of labor and frequently inflicts such damage to an industry that it cannot recover. and the result is further loss of jobs. Minnesota has acquired a reputation recently as a center of labor unrest and the scene of frequent strikes and lockouts. Here again, I charge that the heavy share of the responsibility for that reputation lies beneath the dome of our state capitol. A further share of it lies upon that small minority of men in industry who are unfair to labor, who abuse the powers that their positions of ownership and management give them. A third share lies upon that small minority of radical labor agitators who prey on labor and industry alike and incite unnecessary violence and premature strikes. Have you any idea what strikes and lockouts cost? Do you realize the suffering in the homes of the men locked out or on strike as the wives and children are penalized when either capital or labor, with an ineffective government standing by, try to settle their problems by caveman tactics? Here are some examples. Last summer, during May and June, the St. Paul Plasterers Union called a strike which lasted 8 weeks. The records show that there was a drop of 146 in the number of residences built in 1937 compared to 1936, and a drop of $745,000 in expenditures for building. The strike is the only logical reason for the drop. Actually, a building boom had started in St. Paul last spring, and there is every indication that the strike was directly responsible for a drop of at least $2 million in construction expenditures. This means that the building tradesmen lost around $1 million in wages, and dealers in materials and supplies lost close to $1 million worth of their business. And of course, retail merchants dealing with both workmen and employers lost hundreds of thousands of dollars of business, and everyone else suffered directly or indirectly. Last fall, strikes in several St. Paul laundries led to a lockout, which began September 15th and kept 24 laundries closed until November 28th. Approximately 1,100 employees were idle for 10 and a half weeks and lost an estimated $230,000 in wages. The laundries involved lost an estimated $500,000 in business during the weeks they were closed. In a small community, such a loss would be a major disaster. In a large city such as St. Paul, its effect was not disastrous, but it did its share to injure business and cause more unemployment. Regardless of the issues involved in these two labor disputes, and regardless of which side won, it is apparent that the employers and the employees and the general public all lost, and lost heavily. It is further apparent that the present state administration has made no attempt to set up any governmental machinery to aid in avoiding or settling these disputes. If I were governor tomorrow, I would set to work immediately to do my share to bring about and maintain peace and harmony between business and labor. I feel that it should be possible to work out a method of settling almost all labor disputes without resorting to these caveman tactics of the lockout and the strike. The men to work out such a labor relations act are the responsible leaders of organized labor and the forward-looking employers of Minnesota, working together. If we could succeed in developing in Minnesota a sound labor act, we would have removed a major cause of unemployment in Minnesota. We could attract new industries. We could compete with other states that are putting on nationwide campaigns to bring factories to their state. We could then assist in developing through research laboratories new frontiers of industry as new and better uses for our natural resources are found. This is the avenue we must travel to new jobs and less unemployment. What a tragedy it is that so many of the men in high offices today appear more interested in cashing in politically on the misfortunes of the unemployed than they are in finding jobs for them. So long as those men occupy high places in our state and continue with their preaching of hatred and intolerance, we cannot expect new jobs and new industries. I would make it my business to call together these leaders of business and labor. I would ask them, not only for their own sake, but for the future welfare of their state, to sit down around the conference table, make a real attempt to agree on a labor relations statute for Minnesota. A chief executive of the state could offer suggestions to such a group, but he should not attempt to dictate the specific provisions of the law. He could and should lend the full support of his office to a campaign for enactment into law of such a measure when such a group of labor leaders and employers could agree upon it. Such a conference might well study the experiences of the Scandinavian countries. In Sweden and Norway, under their Labor Relations Act, they have worked out a system that seems to function very well. They have not taken away this right to strike, but they have set up such a machinery for effective arbitration and for the enforcement of contracts between capital and labor that strikes are extremely rare. The right of collective bargaining is recognized. The unions are strong, but the general welfare and the peaceful employment of men in industry is protected. A special labor court sees to it that both capital and labor abide by their contracts. These conferees should also consider the provisions of the Wagner Labor Act. This act provides for enforcement nationally of labor's legally recognized right to organize and engage in collective bargaining, provides penalties for discrimination by employers against employees for union membership or activity. The Wagner Act, however, makes no provision for any method of settling labor disputes if collective bargaining fails. In this respect, the provisions of the National Railway Labor Act might well be studied for suggestion. The Railway Labor Act sets up a complete system for conciliation, mediation, arbitration, and emergency action to settle labor disputes before there is a final resort to a strike. It is a model that has proven its workability. For in the 12 years since its enactment, there have been almost no major strikes on the railroad. One fact has been brought home to me most forcibly in the labor disputes with which I have had personal contact as a public official. That fact is that negotiations to settle a dispute are many times easier if they take place before a strike or lockout actually has occurred and not afterwards. Once the employees and factory are idle, grievances on both sides become intensified, tempers are frayed, and the attitude on both sides of the controversy are much more hostile. Perhaps one reason why the Railway Labor Act has been so effective is that it requires a period of negotiations and mediation during which both sides of the controversy are required to maintain the status quo. In other words, it sets the employers and the employees down around a conference table before their tempers are too aroused to permit a sensible discussion of points at issue. How can the people of Minnesota make progress in the elimination of industrial welfare? How can they make progress in the solution of the other serious problems of the state? The present state administration has amply demonstrated its inability and lack of qualifications to work out such a program. The action of the present officials of Minnesota in labor disputes reminds one of the bystanders who, seeing two men square off for a fight, says to one of them, "Here, I'll hold your coat." The present administration's intemperate attacks on all business has destroyed all chance of cooperation, and its leaders insist on promoting the interests of one faction of organized labor against those of the longer established trade union movement. Apparently, this discrimination is to be made the subject of an investigation by business agents of the unions of Minneapolis. And judging from the reports of administration meddling into the internal affairs of labor unions, it's high time for such an investigation. There is a further reason why the machine politicians in control of the Capitol cannot be trusted to solve this labor relations problem. It would be essential to the success of any Labor Relations Act that the administrative personnel be completely free from any possible coercion. There is only one method of ensuring such freedom, a strong civil service law. I have stated, and I here reiterate, that a strong civil service law will be the cornerstone of my administration. A constructive approach to our problems can be made only through a reorganized, revitalized Republican Party with its eyes to the future and not on the past. It should be our purpose, our resolve, to build in Minnesota a government and state administration which will spare our children the perplexing problems, the staggering burdens, and the unnecessary dissension which we face today. Ours today should be the task of that aged traveler, of that splendid poem, who, having crossed the canyon, turned when he reached the other side and built a bridge to span the tide. "Old man," said a fellow pilgrim near, "why build you this bridge at eventide?" "Good friend, in the way I have come," he said, "there follows after me today a youth whose feet must pass this way. This dream, which has been hard for me, may to that youth a pitfall be. He may pass in the twilight dim. Good friend, I build this bridge for him." Friend, for such constructive building in Minnesota, we shall carry on.
For copies of Mr. Stassen's speech, or for any information on the campaign, you're invited to address a letter or card to the Stassen for Governor Volunteers at South St. Paul in Dakota County. You have just heard Mr. Harold E. Stassen speaking at the 1st District Stassen for Governor Volunteers Banquet and Radio Broadcast. Peter Lyman speaking. Mr. Stassen's talk came to you through the facilities of KROC in Rochester and originated in the Rochester High School.
This is WCCO with studios in Minneapolis and St. Paul.